All right, we have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket and one case on our 10:30 docket. We'll proceed through case number 1 and 2, then we'll take a short recess until the 10:30 docket is called. Megan.
May it please the court, Mr. William Harris arguing for appellant and Mr. James Gibson arguing for the state.
Thank you. Mr. Harris.
Good morning, ladies. That's the first chance I've had to say ladies to a panel here, so it's good to see you this morning.
Good morning.
If it pleases the court, I'm going to address my second and third issues regarding the comments of the prosecutor during argument first, the Batson issue second, and then conclude, if I have time, with addressing the issue about the hearsay statements. In this trial, which was a trial for capital murder in which the state had waived the death penalty, there was a great deal of testimony from various citizens of the community, the Como community, where it occurred, but there was no physical evidence that directly linked either Mr. Phillips, the co-defendant, or Mr. Jackson, my client and the appellant, to the murder of Edward Witt, as he was commonly referred to at trial. During the closing arguments, and I might add, Mr. Jackson, as the court knows, did not testify on his own behalf. He presented two alibi witnesses and cross-examined the witnesses that the state presented. I'm trying to recall. I believe that's all the testimony that he put on, but I'm certain he did not testify. Two comments were made regarding his defense by the defense attorney, both of which were objected to at trial as being comments on the defendant's failure to testify. I have characterized them in the brief as being indirect because they're not quite as direct as saying, for example, there's someone here we haven't heard from, as happened once in Waco. But instead, they're comments in which statements were attributed personally to the defendant. By the way, I have supplied a letter brief with three case citations that I'm going to mention in argument that are not included in the brief, and I've given a copy to Mr. Gibson, so for the court's convenience, I'll refer to them, but the full citation is in the letter brief. The first of those is Cherry versus State, and I refer to Cherry because there is some language in here. It's a 74 opinion out of the Court of Criminal Appeals, but the thing that's striking is they say that the choice of the word I contradicts the theory that the prosecutor was referring to witnesses other than the appellant. In this instance, both of the comments made by the prosecutor were comments that used a personal pronoun that could only have referred to the appellant, using them in front of the jury. The first comment was, quote, that the defendant didn't know that we knew he went back to the scene, so he had to shift gears a little bit. Now, all of a sudden, he went back to the scene. Yes, he admits he was there. Quote, I was there, but if I was there, and then the objection interrupts the sentence. Immediately after that, the prosecutor explained to the court that his intention was to refer to the defense, not the defendant. Perhaps if this was the only time a similar statement was made by the prosecutor, that might be more persuasive, despite the fact that he did use a personal pronoun, I, and attributed that statement directly to the non-testifying defendant. However, moments later, he made a second comment. And in that comment, he said, in their defensive theory about Como turning him in, was shot out of the water on day two. And now Friday afternoon to Monday morning, the alibi witnesses that were called up were shot out of the water. That is not true. If he was going to lie to you about that, then he's guilty of capital murder. Again, he is a personal pronoun that necessarily in this context must have referred to the appellant because it associates the lie with the appellant's guilt with no differentiation. Now, perhaps if he had said, if defense counsel was going to lie to you about this, and then, of course, the objection might be striking at the defendant over the shoulder of counsel, but instead he attributed it to the defendant. The same objection was made, interposed, and again was overruled. Both of these were overruled. At the conclusion of the trial, the defendant was found guilty of capital murder. Since the death penalty was waived, the sentence was an automatic life sentence. With respect to harm, the analysis that I've made in the brief basically is adopted from a case, Waldo versus State, in which the issue was actually use of post-arrest silence rather than the failure to testify at trial. But the analysis I would submit is instructive in trying to evaluate harm in this particular instance. There are several elements. First, the persistence of the prosecution in commenting on the silence. You've got two comments that were made by the prosecutor in close proximity to one another at the end of the argument after he admittedly tried to explain the first comment away as being a comment attributable to the defense globally rather than the defendant specifically, despite its language.
But isn't his language basically descriptive of the scenario and the alibi testimony? In other words, he's trying to shoot down the story as opposed to pointing to the fact that the appellant did not testify.
That may well have been his intention, but the problem is, at least, you know, it's been many, 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 many years ago since I was a prosecutor, but the way we were schooled, you didn't make that kind of personal reference to a defendant when you were arguing. There are obvious ways to get around that. You could simply say the defense has been shot out of the water, or the defense is a lie. The defense has put forward evidence in two witnesses that you may choose to believe were lying, or that I submit to you were lying. And there are a number of ways to say it. You do not have to characterize this as being a comment made by the defendant. And what you do when you do that, I submit, is you encourage the jury, who is not schooled in these distinctions in the way that we are, you encourage the jury to do just exactly what they're instructed not to do, to consider the failure of the defendant to testify, to consider that this is what he was saying indirectly. And it is an indirect comment, but it, I think, still salient. It was a bad choice of words, and having been caught once in trying to explain it, the prosecutor went back to the same terminology and repeated it, which only reinforced it. The other things, the flagrancy of the violation, I would submit this is an instance in which it is flagrant because of the two comments being made in such close temporal proximity to one another. There's another element is the particular instruction given. That doesn't apply in this instance since there was no limiting instruction given by the court. The weight of the incriminating evidence. This is a case in which the incriminating evidence was not overwhelming necessarily. There was testimony by accomplices. There was a tendency to do a certain amount of, you know, this is the guy that did it, that's the guy that did it. There was evidence from the bystander witness to the effect that the description of the person that actually killed Ewitt was probably James Phillips because of the stature and the complexion and the color of the gun. There was other testimony that shifted that around. There was testimony that I'll mention here in a minute from one witness, Kenneth Francis, that Mr. Jackson was the killer, and then also testimony that he was not in a position to see that. That he didn't see who shot the person. So that has some relevancy on this hearsay objection later. Finally, the harm to the accused measured by the severity of the sentence. And, of course, Mr. Jackson received the most severe sentence short of the death penalty that you can receive in our criminal justice system. So appellant's position on this is that this is an instance in which these comments were necessarily an indirect comment on his failure to testify. They were an attribution of statements to him that he did not make, and they were therefore improper. With respect to the Batson issue, there were, as I mentioned in the brief, five African Americans on the jury panel within the strike zone. One was excused by agreement when an objection to cause was made by the state and the defense agreed that this was a well-founded objection. The second was dismissed peremptorily by the defense because he was an active Fort Worth police officer, the same department that had investigated the case. The other three were stricken by the state. One point of confusion here, there were two Ms. Grays on the panel. One sat on the jury, she was the non-African American one, and one was stricken peremptorily by the state. That's apparent, I think, if you read the dialogue between the parties, the exchange between the parties during the Batson objection, and if you check the jury list. But it is a bit confusing when you see the jury polled and Ms. Gray, who I'm complaining about being stricken, is apparently sitting on the jury. In fact, it was a different Mrs. Gray. Now, of the three that were stricken, appellant isn't raising an issue with the other two, although they're the way they were treated might lend some credence to the fact that their being African American had something to do with their being stricken. But there were clearly some reasons with each of them that are, in case law have been approved as being race neutral. For example, one of the jurors had a brother who had a conviction for selling drugs. And while he was described as a drug dealer, which may or may not have been accurate, he at least had one conviction for doing that, and that was an issue in the facts of this case. But with Ms. Gray, the problem essentially was that she had some problems with the law of parties as it applied to capital murder cases. And I suggest this is not an illogical problem. People find that the person sitting out in the car and the getaway driver that planned on a robbery but not a murder, when it turns into a murder, suddenly is looking at capital murder when it was never their intention to create that level of harm. And a lot of times I would submit that the Venari people are basically reflecting a layman's position that this is disproportionate to what that individual's role was, even though it's clearly the law. Several of the Venari persons expressed some concern about that disproportion, and that's reflected in the different dialogues that take place between both the defense counsel and the prosecutor. Ms. Gray, however, in her first statement, said that she did not agree with the law that would make a non-principal accomplice guilty or potentially guilty of capital murder, the law of parties, but that she could follow it. The prosecution pursued that and continued to question her on that point until it finally got a statement from her that she would perhaps have difficulty following that law. They didn't submit her for cause, but they subsequently used that as the explanation for why she was stricken. Now, in the brief, I apologize. I talked about a Venari person named Jurica and also one named Joyner at some length about Joyner. Ms. Joyner did not sit on this jury, but Ms. Jurica did. And the important thing to look at, I believe, in this point with Ms. Jurica is the fact that she also said that a very similar statement to Ms. Gray, I disagree with the law of parties, but I could follow it. That's accepted. It's described by the prosecutor as perfect, and they move on, and she sits on the jury. There's no challenge to her. There's no, and by challenge, I mean not only is there no challenge for cause, there's no challenge in the exchange between her and the prosecutor about her position that was the subject of some considerable questioning with Ms. Gray, who is African-American.
Well, doesn't the questioning go further with Mrs. Gray? Because there's follow-up questions that I guess I haven't read the record regarding Ms. Jurica, but in your brief, I mean, the questioning really goes further.
The question does continue, and that's my point. It does go further, but essentially the complaint that the prosecution has, or being the, let me rephrase this, the justification the prosecution gives for the exercise of the peremptory is based upon her problem with the law of parties. And she is questioned more extensively on that. Ms. Jurica, it's one line. She says, I have trouble with that as being fair, but I could follow it. And Mr. Huseman says, that's perfect, and he moves on. And she's not questioned further on it. And that's a very disparate treatment. Now, Mr. Gibson has pointed out, and I can't gainsay what he has said about our state law in terms of the burdens on the appellant in a Batson case, requiring that the appellant go forward. But I would like to point out that a problem I think we face is that we are throwing up procedural barriers that are not dissimilar to the procedural barrier that Swain versus Alabama threw up to preventing the exercise of peremptory strikes for racial reasons. And Batson recognized that Swain had never yielded an enforceable instance of reversing a case. Because of that, they changed the law. We've created similar problems. Real quickly, because I'm about out of time, I'd like to call the court's attention to a couple of issues on this hearsay problem. The first is that with respect to some claim in the record that this was a statement against interest, I would simply point out to the court that the rule against the exception on the statement against interest requires in criminal cases that there be corroboration. In criminal cases, a statement tending to expose the defendant to criminal liability is not admissible unless corroborating circumstances clearly indicate the trustworthiness of the statement. In fact, corroborating circumstances in this record show that the statement was not trustworthy because the declarant admitted he did not see what he was testifying to or making a statement about. Second, with respect to spontaneous utterance, I would submit to the court that the important thing in a spontaneous utterance is not just the emotional state, but the extent to which you can discern from all the circumstances, including the emotional state, that this is not a statement that bears reflection, has a self-serving element. This statement, I submit, was self-serving. This was a man who was involved in the robbery, thus involved in the murder, and wanting to cast blame on somebody other than himself. He did not show the emotions that were described by Ms. Clark when he was in his bath, when he was in the car going from the scene. This developed later. Whether they were genuine or not, remorse at this situation is not being in the grip of a spontaneous emotion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Mr. Gibson.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'll start with the closing argument issues also. The first comment, I was there, but if I was there, first of all, I'd like to point out that quotation marks in this record are obviously an editorial decision on the part of the court reporter. I don't know if he was doing air quotes or something like that. And obviously he used the word I, but I think in context, this is obviously a reference to defense counsel's argument. And Mr. Harris took the words out of my mouth when he said that, well, he could have said defense counsel, but that probably would have been objectionable too. I think it was probably better in context to say exactly what he says, that look, here's the defense. Yeah, you've shown that my alibi witnesses are lying. Okay, I was there, but if I was there, .. And I don't think that a juror would have taken that as even an indirect comment on the fact that the guy didn't testify, because that's not the point of the statement at all. We don't care that he didn't testify. What we care about is the fact that he's presented witnesses, and there's some evidence that he actually procured, or that the defendant himself procured untruthful testimony, for lack of a better word, in order to support an alibi. So the state's comment was an attack on kind of this shifting defense. And I don't see that there's anything particularly wrong with characterizing defense counsel's argument or the defense as originating with the defendant. It's not as if, I think in context, nobody there thought that the guy was actually saying or got up and stood up in court and said, you know, okay, look, I was there, but if I was there. In that sense, because it was a reference to the defense, to the argument that defense counsel was making, then I think that it's acceptable. And with regard to the...
Isn't that its point, that it didn't say with reference to the defense or the defense counsel, it said he.
Right. But I think that I don't see any particular problem with attributing a defense to the defendant himself. It's not as... Again, it's nobody's arguing that the man actually said those things. And given the counterfactual nature of what he stood up and said, I think that the judge was it was within the bounds of reason to conclude that, well, you know, he's not attributing an actual statement. He's merely using a shorthand description of what the defense is. And with regard to the choice of the word I, it's not as if he was, like in the case that was cited by Mr. Harris, it's not as if he was trying to attribute or substituting I for the actual witnesses that testified. He is using the defendant as a kind of a as a representation of what the defense is. And given the nature of the objection, it just doesn't seem that there's any even indirect comment on the fact that he didn't testify. I mean, everybody knows he didn't testify. It's just simply a shorthand way to say, okay, now he's clutching at straws. He, the defendant. I mean, it's, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with that in particular. And it probably would have been worse if he'd said, you know, defense counsel is now saying this, you know. Perhaps he should have said the defense, then it completely would have been unobjectionable. But he chose that. I don't think that it was, in context, even an indirect comment on his refusal to testify. With regard to the second statement, if he's going to lie to you about that, then he's guilty of capital murder. He is referring to the defense, it's not the defendant testifying. It's, again, there's some evidence that he approached these witnesses to try to get this alibi defense. And I think it's more than a fair inference that a guilty defendant is going to try to get somebody to give him a false alibi. It may not always be true, but it's a fair inference for the prosecutor to make. So in that regard, I don't see the use of the word he in there. And again, we're not talking about he's not actually lying. He's not on the stand perjuring himself, but in a way, in the prosecutor's view, he's kind of a party to lying. If he actually went out there and asked these people to come up with an alibi for him that turns out not to be true, then I think that's a fair game for comment.
Do you have a case that is on point for your position on if he is going to lie? It seems to me like if the prosecutor said if he's going to lie, he's implying if he was telling the truth, he would have gotten up here and said something. He would have testified differently than all these people that have lied.
No, I don't have a case directly on point, but I don't take it as necessarily a kind of a putting in opposite, you know, therefore he must be, he wouldn't get up here to tell the truth. I think that in context, again, he's talking about the defense, that look, if he's going to put up these witnesses, which he did, or there's evidence that he did, and certainly the defense itself put up those witnesses. And if there's evidence that they weren't telling the truth, and again there is, then it's reasonable to point out that, well, look, it's there's some untruthfulness going on here, and who is ultimately responsible for it? I don't think that that by itself is particularly objectionable, at least in the sense of, well, that's an allusion to the fact that he didn't get up there and testify. But again, I couldn't find anything that was particularly on point with regard to a statement like that. Again, probably would have been better to say, you know, if the defense is going to present these witnesses, you know, you can infer that he's hiding something.
Why don't you address the harm issue?
I think that, again, given the evidence, this case did not rest on the fact that he came up with an alibi defense that turned out to be untruthful. And in that regard, I mean, that was rebuttal evidence that was certainly helpful, but there was evidence of the admissions that he made to people who were not accomplices. There was the accomplice testimony. There were the other statements that were made. Again, there's a little bit of conflicting evidence of what actually happened at the scene, but given the evidence of his involvement in the crime, I think these comments were relatively minor, again, because they dealt with this alibi evidence, which it's not really a slam dunk for either side. He was there after the murder. That was how the alibi evidence, the alibi testimony, excuse me, was sort of demolished. I guess is the best way to put it. So, in that regard, we don't think there's any harm. Moving to the Batson claim. My main focus here is to point out that, yes, there's a procedural issue that's involved here, but I think it's a little bit more than that. I think everybody agrees that when asked, the prosecutor gave a race-neutral explanation. Perfectly reasonable to strike somebody because I think, as she put it, she was uncomfortable or would have or had trouble applying the law of parties. Then the prosecutor gave some race-neutral explanations about the other two or three Vannar persons. And then the judge turned to defense counsel, who said, you know, asked if there was anything further, and I believe that the response was, the only one that concerns me is number four. Ms. Gray was number three, the Vannar person who's the subject of this point of error. And then there was an interesting discussion about juror number four and I think another, or a Vannar person number four and another Vannar person. But it seems that it's a little bit difficult to fault the trial court and the prosecutor when the defendant essentially said, well, okay, oh, if that's your explanation, and I think it's a reasonable inference that the judge regards him saying, well, if that's your explanation, then okay, let's move on to number four. So he didn't really try to persuade the court that it was a pretext. As a matter of fact, he seemed to have accepted that it was a race-neutral reason that would withstand scrutiny. And that's why I don't really think that that's the kind of procedural barrier that Mr. Harris is talking about that would result in all Batson claims being demolished.
So what exactly do you think should have been said to raise the pretextual argument in the
trial? Well, if he had a problem specifically with disparate questioning, for example, which is what he brought up in response to Justice Livingston's question earlier, he could have said, well, you know, you harassed her, but you didn't ask follow-up questions of this person. I don't think there's any particular problem with it. It was a conversation with both of them. But that would have been a reasonable thing to point out to the judge that, look, I've got a problem with his reason. I think it's a pretext. It's almost as if he heard the explanation and was satisfied with it, and I don't think we can fault the trial court for accepting that and overruling at least that particular objection.
So are you saying, in other words, that he failed to preserve error?
Well, it's kind of like a preservation issue, yes, but it's also has to do with kind of the shifting burdens in the context of a Batson claim. But it comes pretty close to, I mean, if you didn't raise a Batson claim at all and tried to raise it on appeal, it would be unpreserved. And I think, in a way, this is, I don't know if preservation is the right word or kind of a waiver or an acquiescence, but it certainly falls into that category. Sure, Your Honor.
But the defense counsel doesn't have the transcription of Fort Dyer or have any of the, you know, the information which in a capital murder case, even if the death penalty is waived, I assume can be quite extensive. So I'm not sure exactly what you think needed to happen.
Well,
that's what I'm asking.
Sure. But obviously, if something bothered him about it and if he thought that the prosecutor was lying about it, I mean, it's just like any other preservation issue in which...
Say I still object? I mean, I'm seriously trying to understand exactly what the procedure is supposed to be.
Okay. Well, as I said before, I mean, if he just... I don't think it's enough to say, well, after hearing that, the only... what is it again? The only one that I guess concerns me is number four. It sounds like he's, for lack of a better word, given up on number three, and he's moved on to the other people. Like any preservation issue, it would always be nice to have the record to say, this happened here, or, you know. But in this case, I think that his sort of, it's almost an affirmative acceptance of what the prosecutor said, because this is what it comes down to, is whether the prosecutor is lying, really. It's whether it's a pretextual explanation, that he's made up something. And once he explains it and it appears that everybody accepts it, then I think we just move on to the next persons, which is what happened in this case.
Well, can it be pretextual without an intent to be lying?
Yes. I suppose there are circumstances where it could be, but, I mean, we're not trying to get inside the head. I mean, I was using lying as a kind of a shorthand, but pretextual, surely it's got to be, it's kind of covering up for what's really going on. And if he's sort of making up explanations, I think it's incumbent on the person who's making the Batson objection to not accept that and to say, okay, well, here's why you should, or here's why we think it's a pretext, basically. And as opposed to just saying, okay, that's fine, let's move on to number four. I think that's a signal to the judge anyway that that he doesn't really have a problem with it. Don't know if the red light is working, but I think my time is up. As far as the hearsay point is concerned, we'll rely on our brief. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. Mr. Harris.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll actually try to be brief, but I've rarely succeed in that. First off, on the last issue, the last two case citations on the letter brief, Evans and Zuliani, relate to the spontaneous utterance or excited utterance issue, just for clarification. Jumping back now to the context, to the comments made by the prosecutor that I have suggested were comments on the failure to testify. The point is exactly that there is easily appropriate wording to handle the situation that doesn't require attribution of lies or statements to a non-testifying defendant. If anybody lied on the alibi issue, and I don't necessarily concede that that's the case, there were things about the manner of testimony by the alibi witnesses and contradictions between the two alibi witnesses that could certainly have caused the jury to disbelieve them. Whether that is a lie, whether that is their remembrance, those are issues for the jury to struggle with. They did, and they clearly resolved them against the defendant. But describing them or attributing them to the defendant as a lie is something very different. And you're not entitled, just because somebody doesn't testify, to come up there and make up what he has said. That's why I call it an indirect comment. It's not saying he didn't testify, but if he had, he would have said. Now, that would be direct. But rather attributing these statements to him when it was equally easy to say the defense has put forward alibi witnesses who lied. Now, that is a conclusion that could be drawn from the testimony. Would have been a perfectly legitimate prosecutorial argument, a conclusion drawn from the evidence. There wouldn't have been a good objection to it. Obviously, if he had said defense counsel lied, yes, that'd be striking at the defendant over the shoulder of counsel. But that middle ground was perfectly legitimate and easily used. To then turn around and repeat the same thing after disavowing that purpose is an indication, at a minimum, of inartfulness on the part of the prosecutor, acknowledging that he had crossed a bound and clarifying it and then turning around and doing the same thing. And he's going back to the same conduct. And this is constitutional error. So it's not just a matter of, well, it really wasn't harmful. The harm standard is, can the court find beyond a reasonable doubt that no harm was done by these statements? And that's a much more rigorous harm standard for the state in claiming that the error was harmless than the regular standard of harm in evidentiary matters. With respect to Batson, I should clarify myself quickly. Judge Walker made the exact point that is the problem for the trial attorney under the current Batson rules. And it's not a waiver of appellate issue point so much as a failure, an alleged failure to carry the burden of proof. And there are cases that say the burden doesn't shift from the defense just because there's a requirement for the state to come forward with race-neutral explanations. The problem for the defense attorney, and why I'm saying that this may make Batson a nullity as a practical matter, is you don't have a transcript of what went on in voir dire. And every trial attorney, and I suspect every appellate attorney and everybody that does both, knows that human memory is fallible and that counsel's memory of exactly what was said in a 4 or 5 or 6 hour voir dire process, much less in a death penalty case where the voir dire process goes on for weeks, nobody has an encyclopedic memory of that. And to place on the defendant a burden that the defendant has to be able to say exactly what the problem is and what was said and what was asked is an impossible burden that human beings, other than, I know one guy with a photographic memory, Michael Tiger, he probably could do it, but I'm not Michael Tiger, much to my chagrin. That's something a defense can't manage. The second point is, if you look at the record, the point was not conceded. I was the trial counsel. The judge asked if there was anything else. It wasn't like, well, that I'm still worried about number four conceding on number three. There's the intervention of a question from the bench. Is there anything else, Mr. Harris? And then the reply is, yes, I'm concerned about number four and the colloquy that takes place then. That's where I think the procedural problem with this burden on the defense is taking us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Mr. Gibson, your case is submitted. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. We'll proceed to case number 2 on the docket, Mateer versus Kabul Lease.